You're listening to an Airwave Media Podcast.
Denk an den 31. Juli.
Wieso?
Last Call für deine Steuer.
Oh no, ich weiß gar nicht, wo ich anfangen soll.
Weil wieso Steuer? Das ist wie Steuererklärung, nur ohne Stress.
Ist das einfach?
Klar, macht fast alles automatisch.
Dauert das lange?
Nö, einfach per App.
Na dann.
Hol dir jetzt dein Geld zurück mit Wieso Steuer. Bis zum 31. Juli abgeben.
Welcome to the Age of Napoleon. Episode 114, The Limits of Power. Thanks for joining me. As always, I'd like to start by inviting you to join us on Patreon. I just finished the 23rd of our special patrons-only bonus episodes. In a few weeks, it will be 2 years since I started doing these. That means there's almost 2 years of content waiting for you for just $2 a month. And of course, Patreon is the only place to get ad-free versions of the regular episodes. Anyway, we left off last time in late July 1808, with the surrender of a huge French column under General Pierre Dupont after their defeat at the Battle of Bailen. All over Spain, the new juntas were raising armies and laying the groundwork for long-term resistance to the French. Napoleon's plan to bring Spain fully under French influence had blown up in his face. Before the fighting broke out, Napoleon said of this intervention, quote, "If I thought it would cost me 80,000 men, I would not attempt it, but it will cost me no more than 12,000. End quote. Only a few weeks after the first battle of the war, it was already double that number. By the time the last French soldier left Spain, his troops would suffer around 250,000 casualties in this theater of the war. It's worth dwelling on the immediate impact of the Battle of Bailen within Spain. As I mentioned last episode, roughly 1 in 5 French soldiers in the country were killed or captured by Castaños's army. That had important strategic implications, and obviously it was a huge blow to French morale. Bonaparte ordered fresh reinforcements to Spain, although these were more second-line troops, mostly non-French and inexperienced, taken from garrisons in Italy. He wanted to bring the cream of the Grande Armée to Spain and personally lead them against the Patriots, but as we'll see later in this episode, he needed to lay some diplomatic and strategic groundwork before that would be possible. Bonaparte also ordered a fresh round of conscription. 160,000 young Frenchmen would be called to the colors. We've seen this before. It was part of Napoleon's standard response to a military setback. At this point in history, European demographics were quite different than they are today. France was the most populous country in Western Europe, and its population was very young. 160,000 is a big number, and these periodic call-ups and the constant casualties were taking a toll. However, France could sustain these losses, at least for now. Napoleon also removed General René Savary as overall commander of French forces in Iberia. Savary had been an interim leader, brought in to fill the position temporarily after Marshal Murat's breakdown. He had been appointed before Bonaparte fully understood the seriousness of the situation. He was a capable person, but not well suited to the role. His replacement would be a familiar figure, Marshal Michel Ney, one of the most famous and well-regarded commanders in the whole French military. In the meantime, the remaining French forces in Spain had little choice but to fall back towards France. As we discussed last episode, they were scattered across almost the entire country, in relatively small detachments, each trying to maintain control over the local area from the rising Patriot tide. The disaster at Bailen, combined with other setbacks in the opening weeks of the war, proved this was no longer tenable. All around them, the Patriots grew stronger, more confident, and better organized. To remain scattered across the country would simply be inviting more defeats. And so, most of the remaining French units in Spain began to march towards the Pyrenees. They would not evacuate the country entirely, instead taking up new positions in the north and east, leaving most of Spain under the rule of the juntas. Joseph Bonaparte, theoretically king of Spain, was part of this retreat. He fled his capital of Madrid for a safer base of operations in the city of Burgos. The officers and officials around Joseph commented that he showed strength of character during this period, throwing himself into the hard work of managing the retreat and acting as a strong, steady presence in a headquarters that was now plagued by doubt and confusion. Credit to Joseph, he was doing a good job of hiding his true feelings. His letters to his brother from this period tell a very different story. Quote, "This people is more determined in its feelings of resentment than any other in Europe. Your Majesty has no idea, because no one will have told you, how much your name is hated here. Fever is in the masses of the nation. The voice of reason and conciliation can do nothing. A Bonaparte will only keep his throne by treating the Spaniards as they themselves treated the subjects of Montezuma." End quote. Montezuma being the Aztec emperor who was overthrown by the Spanish conquistadors. Napoleon tried to reassure his brother, quote, "It is not a question of dying, but of living and being victorious, and you are, and you shall be. I will reach the columns of Hercules in Spain, but not the limits of my power." End quote. The Columns of Hercules is an old-fashioned poetic name for the Straits of Gibraltar. In this context, it's more of a shorthand for the furthest reaches of Spain. On the Spanish side, as you might imagine, the news of the victory at Bailén was treated with something approaching euphoria. The Spanish patriots knew they were facing long odds, but Bailén seemed to be proof that victory was possible. Some even saw it as a sign that God was on their side. In the early phase of the war, many Spaniards had been on the fence. The French were massively unpopular, but organized, violent resistance to the occupation seemed futile. Bailén forced some of those people to reconsider their positions, and many came around to supporting the patriots, or even joining the resistance themselves. The prestige and legitimacy of the juntas and the patriot armies had grown exponentially overnight. At Bailén, they had achieved something that the governments of several of the great powers had failed to do for nearly a decade. Under these circumstances, who could deny that this was a movement to be taken seriously? I would imagine every officer and soldier in the Spanish armies walked a little taller and breathed a little easier after hearing the news. There was new confidence and a new sense of purpose among the patriots. They still had a very long road to climb, but Bailén had showed them that there was a viable route to the summit. Some felt Bailén had actually made the Spanish too confident. I don't think it's fair to call the battle a fluke. Castaños had pursued a sound strategy, and his men had fought well. But there were some aspects of the battle that were somewhat unique and would be difficult or impossible to replicate. For starters, most of the Spanish units doing the hard fighting at Bailén were trained regulars from the old Royal Army. In fact, they included some of the best trained and best led of the pre-war Spanish regiments. The average Spanish soldier was an untrained, poorly equipped volunteer. Would the success at Bailén have been possible with only the hastily raised volunteer regiments that made up most of the Patriot forces? Anything is possible, but it certainly would have been a lot more difficult. And it's important to keep in mind that DuPont's column did not represent the cream of the French military. Most of the units captured at Bailén were second-line troops, who, under normal circumstances, would not have been facing the enemy in open battle. Almost all had been raw recruits. Several of DuPont's Swiss regiments had actually defected to the Patriots, an event which may have decided the battle, and which was not likely to be repeated in the future. The French also suffered from poor leadership. DuPont and his subordinates made several questionable decisions, stopping their march in an inhospitable, exposed position, maintaining a huge, ponderous baggage train, dividing their forces in the face of a larger enemy, and launching their attacks on the crucial position outside Bailen piecemeal rather than marshaling all their forces for a single decisive blow, just to name a few of the most glaring mistakes. Even the best commanders are wrong sometimes, and Castaños and his army deserve some credit for forcing those errors. But I find it hard to imagine the best French commanders making so many grievous mistakes in the space of only a few days. How would the events at Bailen have played out with Soult or Lannes or Davout or Napoleon himself in command? But despite these somewhat unique circumstances, for the rest of the war, every Spanish general would dream of replicating Castaños' success. It has been argued by some that these dreams of another Bailen led Patriot generals to take risks, trying to win a decisive victory in open battle when they would have been better served opposing the French indirectly. The Duke of Wellington himself would later complain about this. Years later, when he was leading a mixed Anglo-Spanish army, he often had to warn his Spanish allies that they should not expect another Bailen, to prevent them from getting carried away in battle and seeking the total destruction of the opposing French army. After Bailen, there was plenty of glory and acclaim to be shared among the Spanish officers. Many received medals or promotions or both. Castaños himself got a noble title, becoming Duke of Bailen. One of the heroes of the battle was a young captain from one of the old line regiments of the Royal Army. He was a passionate convert to Enlightenment liberalism, but he had joined the Patriot movement with great enthusiasm, and began distinguishing himself almost as soon as the fighting began. His fellow officers and the junta were so impressed by his performance that he was awarded a medal and promoted all the way to lieutenant colonel, skipping the rank of major. At this time in his life, he was a committed Spanish patriot. However, he had not been born on the mainland. He was a Creole from the province of Corrientes in modern-day Argentina. Later in life, he would be called by many grand titles: Triumvir of the Rio de la Plata, Protector of Peru, and Liberator of America. But in 1808, he was simply Lieutenant Colonel José de San Martín. San Martín would be far from the only person in Latin America whose life would be transformed by this new war. Soon, there would be juntas springing up on the other side of the Atlantic as well. No one could have yet predicted it, but this was the beginning of a momentous chain of events that would take decades to resolve and transform the map of Latin America. We'll have much more to say about this in future episodes. Before we stray too far from the Battle of Bailen, it's worth discussing what happened to the defeated French. After the surrender, General Pierre Dupont, his second-in-command, General Dominique Vidal, and the rest of the senior leadership returned to France. This had all been worked out in the surrender negotiations. The rank and file went into captivity, but the officers were immediately paroled. It might not have been entirely fair, but it was more or less standard procedure for this type of surrender in this era. Dupont had requested that his men be paroled as well, returned to France after signing a written promise not to bear arms against Spain for some set period of time. The Spanish had agreed. However, they did not keep their word. As I said last episode, the war in Spain would be ugly and brutal, and even in these early stages, that was already becoming evident. The prisoners of Bailen were kept in terrible conditions, subjected to neglect and mistreatment by their Spanish captors. Around half died. By contrast, the senior officers were very lucky, although they didn't get away unscathed either. Bonaparte launched an exhaustive inquiry into the defeat. All of the leadership of DuPont's column had to give lengthy testimony explaining their actions. As a result of these proceedings, several officers were officially reprimanded. A few were temporarily suspended from their duties. The two most senior leaders, DuPont and Vidal, were stripped of their ranks and honors and imprisoned. After several years of captivity, Vidal was released and reinstated to the army at his former rank. He even regained command, although he didn't have a chance to do much before the Napoleonic Wars ended. Apparently, he spent the rest of his life trying to justify and explain his actions at Bailen. DuPont was treated more harshly. He was imprisoned at the Château de Joux, the same cold, uncomfortable military prison where Toussaint Louverture spent his last days. Napoleon never granted DuPont clemency. He was finally released and reinstated after the restoration of the old regime in 1814, probably in part due to his conservative politics. When Napoleon briefly regained power in 1815, he fired DuPont again. 7 years later, he had still not forgiven the humiliation of Bailen. Bonaparte became practically obsessed with the battle. He compiled all the reports on Bailen and sent them to his war minister, with a note that read in part, quote, "The enclosed documents are for you alone. Read them with a map, and you will be able to judge whether there was anything so senseless, so stupid, and so dastardly since the world was created. Here are the mocks and Hohenlohe's justified. One can see clearly enough by DuPont's own report that all that happened resulted from his inconceivable folly." End quote. Mach and Hohenlohe refers to two of the most incompetent enemy generals Napoleon had ever faced, at Ulm and Jena, respectively. He wanted to call the minister's attention to this battle so that other generals would not repeat DuPont's failure. Months later, while reviewing troops, Napoleon recognized General François Legendre, DuPont's former chief of staff, who had only recently been reinstated to the army after serving his suspension. Out of the blue, the emperor gave Legendre a stern lecture on the subject of Bailen, then dismissed him before he could defend himself. Clearly, the battle was a big sore spot for Napoleon. He wanted to make it clear that he expected a lot more from his generals. And for good reason. The news of Bailen sent shockwaves across the continent and beyond. It had been years since a major French force had been soundly beaten on the battlefield. Both of the last two wars between the great powers, the wars of the Third and Fourth Coalitions, had seen total French victories, without a single serious defeat. By some measures, France hadn't suffered a major setback on the battlefield since Napoleon took power all the way back in 1799, nearly a decade earlier. Before Bailen, some opponents of Napoleon's new order had begun to despair. After the Treaty of Tilsit, French hegemony seemed almost unassailable. The Empire's armies seemed invincible, and Napoleon's ultimate triumph inevitable. Bailen, and the wider French failure to pacify Spain, were hard proof that things are not always what they seem. Every enemy of Napoleon took heart. It was possible to defy France and win. The Spanish had proved it. As Napoleon himself put it, quote, "DuPont has covered our flags with infamy," end quote. He wanted to go to Spain himself, to show the Spanish and the world that Bailen was nothing but a fluke brought on by the incompetence of second-rate leadership. If Bonaparte himself led the cream of the Grande Armée into Spain, backed up by his best marshals, people would quickly be reminded that the French military was still the best in the world. France's flags would not remain covered in infamy for long. but there was a lot to do before that would be possible. Napoleon had to deal with the diplomatic fallout of this setback. Only then would he have a free hand to bring his best troops to Spain and teach the patriots a lesson. Historians sometimes talk about Bailén in psychological or almost spiritual terms. You see variations on the same phrase again and again. The aura of invincibility had been destroyed. That was certainly true, but there was much more going on here. This wasn't purely in people's heads. The Spanish Rebellion had profound practical implications. The events of the past few months had drastically changed the European strategic picture. Remember, before Napoleon had begun his meddling in Iberia, Spain had been a French ally. Now, almost the entire country was firmly committed to the coalition. Only a few months earlier, Britain lacked any foothold on the continent, and had consistently failed in all its attempts to create one. As we'll discuss next episode, the unfolding chaos in Iberia had given the Redcoats a perfect base of operations on the European mainland. Thousands of British troops had already landed in Iberia, and more would follow. Almost overnight, France's strategic position had become far weaker. These developments were followed with great interest in every European capital, but probably nowhere more so than Vienna. As you might recall, the Austrians had sat out the last war. The Habsburg armies had performed very poorly in their last encounter with the French during the War of the Third Coalition in 1805. General Mack had been humiliated at Ulm, Archduke Charles had been forced to retreat in Italy, Napoleon took Vienna without serious resistance, and then won perhaps the most dazzling victory of his career at Austerlitz. These defeats had cost Austria dearly. Obviously, thousands of soldiers had been killed or maimed, and the prestige of the crown had been tarnished. But they had also been forced to pay a huge monetary indemnity to France, and to make territorial and diplomatic concessions. And remember, this had been Austria's third defeat at the hands of the French in a decade. Three humiliating treaties, three rounds of concessions. One of the worst blows had actually come in peacetime. Napoleon's diplomatic maneuvering in Germany had forced the Habsburgs to abolish the Holy Roman Empire in 1806. As you might recall, by this point, Talleyrand believed the Austrians had had enough. The great diplomat believed all the major diplomatic flashpoints between the two powers had now been settled in France's favor. He also believed the future European geopolitical order would need Austria to serve as a bulwark against the Ottoman Empire, a counterbalance against the rising power of Russia, and to maintain order over Central and Southeastern Europe, an ethnically and religiously diverse region which might easily fall into chaos and conflict if it wasn't united under Habsburg rule. Talleyrand believed the time had come for Austria and France to set aside their long-standing rivalry. Napoleon wanted to forge a new geopolitical status quo for the continent, and Talleyrand couldn't see a stable equilibrium emerging without Austria. Bonaparte disagreed. He thought that Austria was too weak to continue as a major power, and that the old hatreds between France and Austria ran too deep. He had real contempt for the Habsburgs. He considered them incompetent and their state hopelessly backwards. In the emperor's view, détente with Austria was not possible, and probably not desirable either. And so, Austria had stayed out in the cold. Much of the Grande Armée remained in Germany, where they could easily be concentrated to oppose any hostile move by the Austrians. On the other side of the border, the Habsburgs poured huge resources into rebuilding their military, yet again. But this time was different. As you might recall from earlier episodes, after past defeats, the Habsburg military leadership had been divided into two factions. There was the Old Guard, who wanted to stick to tried and true methods. They wanted the army to be rebuilt quickly. so it could be back in the field challenging the French as soon as humanly possible. On the other side was the Young Guard. They believed those tried-and-true methods were actually a big part of the problem. They saw the Habsburg military as old-fashioned, and believed fundamental reforms were needed if Austria hoped to seriously challenge the French ever again. Before the War of the Third Coalition, the Old Guard had won the argument, to disastrous results. No surprise, once Austria found itself defeated again, Emperor Francis II listened to the Young Guard, in particular his own younger brother, Archduke Charles, a leading member of the Reform faction, who was named Supreme Commander of all Habsburg forces. And so, when the new coalition came calling in 1806, the Austrians turned them down. It was a golden opportunity, with Prussia finally getting off the fence to unite against Napoleon. But it hadn't even been a year since Austerlitz. The Habsburg military was still rebuilding, and in the midst of massive and very disruptive reforms. Given what had happened to the Prussians only a few weeks later, the Austrians were probably relieved they hadn't been ready to join the war. News of French disasters in Spain began reaching Vienna in the midsummer of 1808. By this point, Archduke Charles had been rebuilding and reforming the Habsburg military for 2.5 years. The Archduke and his clique of reformers did not consider their task complete, not by a long shot. However, it was a very different situation from 1806. The Habsburg military had made tremendous strides. It was now larger and better organized than ever before. The Archduke had also led a complete overhaul of doctrine and regulations. Perhaps they still lagged a bit behind the French, but by 1808, this was unquestionably a modern army, and a very different force from the one that had performed so poorly back in 1805. Perhaps unsurprisingly, given their record against the French, the policymakers in Vienna had developed a bit of an underdog mentality. They were very aware of their rivals' strengths, and were not confident they could match them. They knew that if they hoped to defeat Napoleon, they would have to pick their moment very carefully, wait until France was weak or distracted, then and only then making their move. That meant being judicious, not rushing into war prematurely, as had clearly happened in 1805, but also not letting opportunities pass by. With an enemy this strong, moments of weakness or distraction were not likely to come around very often. As they followed the news coming out of Iberia, many within the Austrian leadership began to suspect one of those rare opportunities might soon arrive. They began making preliminary preparations for war. I want to stress that these were preliminary preparations. This was not like World War I, in which giving the general order to mobilize was tantamount to a declaration of war. At the dawn of the 19th century, the great powers could slowly inch towards full mobilization without fully committing themselves, and this is exactly what the Austrians began to do. The French were not blind to these developments. Austrian saber-rattling presented a serious strategic problem for Napoleon. The war in Iberia was being fought by second-line troops. He wanted to bring the Grande Armée back on campaign over the Pyrenees to settle the Iberian problem as quickly as possible. But most of his best units were in Germany. They had been placed there largely to deter any aggression from the Habsburgs. Pulling them away, just as the Austrians began flexing their muscles, would practically invite an invasion. This partial mobilization of the Habsburg military was a smart move by the Austrians. They had put Napoleon in a bind. He would have to either leave his second-line troops in Spain to fend for themselves, or open the entire eastern flank of his empire up to invasion. Napoleon would have to solve this problem before he could even think about gathering the Grande Armée for an invasion of Spain. Fortunately for him, he believed he had a solution at hand: his alliance with Emperor Alexander of Russia. If the Austrians believed Russia would come to France's defense in the event of an invasion, they would be very unlikely to follow through on their threats. Even with the Grande Armée out of Germany, the Habsburgs would stand little chance against the united forces of France and Russia. Technically, the implicit threat of Russian intervention already existed. France and Russia were allies, and allies are supposed to defend each other in the event of aggression by a third party. But Napoleon would have been a fool to trust the fate of his empire to a piece of paper. He wouldn't feel comfortable leading the Grande Armée over the Pyrenees without specific assurances from Alexander, and to get those, he would need to meet the young Russian emperor face to face. There were other good reasons to meet with Alexander. As is often the case with a big momentous treaty, like the Treaty of Tilsit, there were still a few outstanding issues between the two powers that had been overlooked or not anticipated at the first negotiation. Napoleon also wanted to provide assurances that the situation in Spain was only a temporary setback, and to make sure these recent changes to the strategic picture hadn't damaged his relationship with the Russians. And so the two sovereigns would meet for a second time. The city of Erfurt in central Germany was chosen as the venue. Above all, Napoleon wanted to demonstrate to Alexander that although the empire's strategic outlook had darkened slightly since they last spoke, France remained the dominant power in Europe. All the sovereigns of France's German allies would be assembled. Theoretically, this was a diplomatic congress, and they were all attendees, on equal footing with the two emperors. But we all know how little Napoleon listened to his minor allies. In practice, they would be there as reminders of Napoleon's power. He was demonstrating that with the snap of a finger, he could summon half the sovereigns of Europe and use them merely as props if he saw fit. Theatrical troupes would be brought from Paris to perform the most popular plays from the French stage, to remind the assembled guests of the empire's cultural and artistic greatness. There would also be a tour of the nearby battlefield of Jena, where Napoleon had smashed the Prussians only 2 years earlier, just in case anyone had forgotten about the emperor's greatest talent. Bonaparte told his advisors, quote, "I wish to astonish Germany by my splendor," end quote. He wanted Alexander to look beyond the debacle in Spain and see the empire's many strengths, to recapture the feeling of Tilsit, when the two emperors had been wrapped up in mutual fascination, and the two great powers had seemed perfectly matched to dictate the continent's future together, Russia ruling the east, France the west. The meeting at Erfurt would be different. For one thing, Alexander was different. The young Russian emperor had come to Tilsit after losing a war. He had been braced to give up territorial concessions to France. Napoleon would not have the same leverage at Erfurt. At that first meeting, Alexander held a burning personal curiosity about the French emperor. Napoleon was the most famous character of the age, and the central figure of all European geopolitics. The whole continent was speculating about him. What was he really like? How had he been able to accomplish so much in only a few years? Not only that, Alexander was relatively new to the throne. Napoleon clearly knew a great deal about wielding power, and Alexander had a lot to learn. After hours and hours of conversation at Tilsit over the course of days, the Russian emperor's curiosity was sated. Now he was ready to deal with Napoleon as a fellow sovereign, rather than as an inquisitive admirer. In the years since Tilsit, the Russian nobility had never warmed up to the French alliance. In fact, Alexander was practically alone in this policy. Not even his own family approved. This fact had never been far from his mind. He even worried about being assassinated by anti-French members of his own court. That might sound a little far-fetched, but then again, something similar had happened to his father and predecessor just 7 years earlier. At Erfurt, Napoleon's position would be weaker in every conceivable way. His armies had faltered, his strategic vision for Europe was compromised, and his Russian counterpart would be less receptive. These would be sensitive negotiations. Napoleon made a somewhat unorthodox choice to be his right-hand man at Erfurt, not his foreign minister or his chief of staff or his ambassador to Russia, but a man who had left the French foreign policy establishment over his disagreements with Bonaparte, Talleyrand. Not so long ago, Talleyrand and the emperor had agreed they could not continue working so closely together because they no longer shared a vision for the future of French diplomacy. But, on the other hand, these talks at Erfurt were massively important. Napoleon wanted his best foreign policy expert by his side, and there was little doubt in anyone's mind that Talleyrand was the greatest diplomat in France, possibly the whole world. Bonaparte ordered Talleyrand to draft a new treaty, recommitting France and Russia to their alliance, with particular mention of their mutual hostility toward Great Britain and a formal commitment from the Russians to fight the Habsburgs if they invaded the French Empire. Talleyrand presented the emperor with a draft that didn't even mention Austria. According to Talleyrand, Napoleon asked him, quote, "How can you have forgotten that? That is the essential article. Are you still pro-Austrian?" End quote. Talleyrand then replied, quote, "A little, sire. But I think it would be more correct to say that I am never pro-Russian and always pro-French." End quote. A clever dodge, but clearly the two men were still not seeing eye to eye. Talleyrand had a lot invested in this conference. As he put it, quote, "Erfurt. Never has any name produced such an impression on me as that of this outlandish place. I cannot think of it without fear and hope. The fate of Europe and the world, the future of political power, and perhaps of European civilization, depends on it." End quote. In fact, Talleyrand had far more invested in this conference than Napoleon knew. The wily diplomat had come to a fateful decision. He would no longer act as Bonaparte's obedient servant. As he himself said to Napoleon, he had always seen himself, first and foremost, as a servant of France, not of any particular government, and certainly not of any particular individual. He had come to believe his emperor was no longer acting in France's best interests, and so Talleyrand was resolved to pursue his own course, and try to do what he believed was best for the country, even if it meant acting against Bonaparte. He believed Napoleon needed to moderate French foreign policy, stop antagonizing the Austrians, stop throwing his weight around on the world stage, and above all, to accept that there were limits to his power. Erfurt would be an opportunity for Talleyrand to meet face to face with Alexander. He hoped to build a relationship with the Russian emperor, Napoleon's most important ally, and then collaborate with Alexander to impose limits on Napoleon's foreign policy. It was a dangerous move. If Napoleon found out, he would certainly see it as a personal betrayal, probably even as treason. And of course, it was treason. Talleyrand would always claim he was obeying higher loyalties to France and the French people, to Europe and the people of Europe, and, like all great diplomats, to stability and the balance of power. But by any reasonable legal standard, secret collaboration with a foreign government made him a traitor. Of course, this was nothing new for Talleyrand. He had broken bread with the radicals when he served the King of France, and he had maintained his connections to his royalist friends when he served the Revolution. He had associates and acquaintances in every court in Europe, even in countries that were fiercely hostile to France. Some of this was simply being a good diplomat. Even the bitterest of enemies always make peace eventually. These types of back-channel communications and relationships with people on the other side are what make peace possible. And I'm sure if Talleyrand had been caught, this is exactly what he would have said. But what he was planning at Erfurt went far beyond simply building relationships. He would be lying to Napoleon's face, and passing state secrets to a foreign power. It would be a real double cross. The Congress of Erfurt would begin in late September 1808, about 2 months after the disaster at Bailen. Talleyrand arrived first. He had been sent ahead by Napoleon to make sure all the details were just right and to lay the diplomatic groundwork. Conveniently, this also allowed him to lay his own groundwork for the betrayal of the emperor. Napoleon arrived second. By now, an impressive list of monarchs, nobles, and other dignitaries were assembled at Erfurt, and they all lined up to pay their respects to the most powerful man of the age. Talleyrand had a front-row seat and described what he saw. Quote, "The emperor entered Erfurt, September 28, 1808, at 10 in the morning. An immense crowd surrounded the avenues leading to the palace. Everyone wished to see, and would approach, him who dispensed all. Thrones, misery, fears, and hopes. Augustus, Louis XIV, and Napoleon are the men on whom the most praise has ever been bestowed. Times and talent gave different forms to these praises, but they were, in reality, the same thing. My duties enabled me to see the forced, simulated, or even sincere homage which was rendered to Napoleon, more than I could have done otherwise, and gave it proportions which appeared to me monstrous." End quote. As you can see, Talleyrand seemed convinced the acclaim showered on Napoleon was insincere, deference to his power rather than genuine respect. Then again, perhaps he was wallowing in cynicism to make his betrayal easier to stomach. Alexander and the Russian contingent arrived last. Some close to the Russian emperor had begged him not to go. It had only been a few months since Napoleon had lured the Spanish royal family to Bayonne, under the pretext of a diplomatic summit, then practically took them prisoner. Anti-French members of the Russian court and the imperial family worried he might do the same to Alexander. Among the loudest of these voices was his own mother, the Dowager Empress Maria Feodorovna. Alexander wrote her a letter explaining his decision to go to Erfurt. Quote, "The moment chosen for this meeting is such that it impresses on me a duty not to evade it. France has to believe that her political interest can be allied with that of Russia. As soon as France does not have this belief, she will see Russia as no more than an enemy that it will be in her interest to destroy. Was it not in Russia's interest to go along with this fearful colossus, with the sole truly dangerous enemy Russia can have?" End quote. Perhaps that is revealing of Alexander's attitudes, but, on the other hand, he was notorious for telling people what they wanted to hear, and keeping his true feelings to himself. He knew his mother was anti-French. Perhaps he was simply playing to his audience. When Alexander arrived on the 28th, Bonaparte and his entourage rode out to meet the Russians. When the two groups came within eyesight, the emperors rushed forward, throwing their arms around each other in a bear hug, like old friends. Franco-Russian relations may have cooled slightly since Tilsit, but the two sovereigns were at least still acting like their friendship was strong. That night, Talleyrand met privately with Alexander. You might think this had to be done in secret, but Napoleon had actually ordered him to spend as much time as possible with the Russian emperor. Betraying Napoleon was a dangerous game, but the emperor's trust in Talleyrand made it easy. Talleyrand was able to meet with Alexander twice a day during the Congress. At first, their conversations were relatively innocent. Talleyrand was feeling him out. Alexander was almost as cagey. But after a few days together, Talleyrand became convinced the Russian emperor would be receptive to his overtures. The conversations became more serious. Finally, Talleyrand dropped the mask and spoke to Alexander directly. Quote, "Sire, it is in your power to save Europe, and you will only do so by refusing to give way to Napoleon. The French people are civilized. Their sovereign is not. The sovereign of Russia is civilized, and his people are not. The sovereign of Russia should, therefore, be the ally of the French people." End quote. He later elaborated, quote, "The Rhine, the Alps, and the Pyrenees are the conquests of France. The rest are conquests of Napoleon. France has nothing to do with them. The interest of France demands that the powers capable of reining in Napoleon unite to erect a dike to check his insatiable ambition. End quote. Talleyrand counseled Alexander to hold firm on all of Napoleon's demands. Above all, he implored him not to commit Russia to war against Austria, which was Napoleon's primary goal. Years later, in his memoirs, Talleyrand explained that if Napoleon had gotten Russian support against Austria at this time, quote, he would, under some pretext easily invented, have sought a quarrel with Austria, and after a few military successes, he would have tried to do with Austria as he had done with Prussia, end quote. In other words, committing Russia to support Napoleon in a war with Austria would only have made conflict more likely. Another war would have led to another punitive treaty, further weakening Austria, and in doing so, introducing even more chaos onto the European geopolitical scene. Talleyrand believed that, in the end, chaos served no one. Meanwhile, Napoleon was still hoping to recapture the magic of Tilsit. Just like at their first meeting, he planned to spend as much time as possible one-on-one with Alexander. He hoped to use the young Russian emperor's fascination with him, their friendship, and his personal magnetism to secure the guarantees he needed. However, he found Alexander impassive and unreceptive. It seemed the Russians had come to Erfurt hoping to secure more concessions from France, not to support their allies in their time of need. At one point, Napoleon deployed one of his favorite negotiating tactics. The angry tantrum. He threw his hat to the ground and began stomping on it, demanding Russia honor the alliance and provide guarantees against Austria. Alexander responded coolly, quote, "You are violent, and I am stubborn. With me, anger gains nothing. Let us talk and be reasonable, or I am leaving." End quote. Perhaps Bonaparte had gotten too used to negotiating with people who were weak and already under his influence, people who had a genuine reason to fear his displeasure. Alexander had no such fear, and so this tantrum got Napoleon nowhere. Bonaparte lamented, quote, "Emperor Alexander is as obstinate as a clam. That infernal Spanish business is costing me dear," end quote. Little did he know that one of his top advisors was counseling Alexander to be as obstinate as possible. By this point in the conference, Talleyrand had moved well beyond feeling Alexander out and giving him general advice. He was telling the young Russian emperor exactly how to respond to each of Napoleon's arguments before he made them. In fact, Talleyrand gave Alexander so much detailed information that he had to take exhaustive notes. Effectively, he was following Talleyrand's instructions. Whatever else you can say about Talleyrand, it is pretty impressive that he now had both of the most powerful men in the world hanging on his every word, coming to him for advice, and even deferring to him to a degree. Talleyrand was rich enough to live in great luxury, but he was no great financier or captain of industry. He didn't have the kind of real economic power that demands consideration from great monarchs. He did have an impressive political title, Counselor of State, but he was just one member of that body with no independent power. He had no armies or ships under his command. He had no great mass of followers among the average people. In fact, the public generally saw him as corrupt and sinister. He himself probably would have been first to admit that he didn't have any great moral authority either. All Talleyrand really had was his mind and his reputation, and those were enough to bend the most powerful people in the world to his will. As you might imagine, Napoleon was finding his trip to Erfurt vexing, to say the least. But it was not all frustration and futility. The emperor finally got a chance to meet one of the people he most admired in the world, the German writer and intellectual Johann Wolfgang von Goethe. Goethe was 58 years old, and had been one of the most famous and well-respected intellectuals in Europe for decades. Napoleon had been obsessed with his books, reading some of them over and over again. He claimed to have read Goethe's The Sorrows of Young Werther 7 times. Amazingly, almost as soon as the two men were introduced, Napoleon launched into a criticism of Voltaire's play, Mohammed, which Goethe had recently translated into German. As you know from past episodes, Napoleon was a great admirer of Mohammed. Voltaire had been an anti-clerical Enlightenment deist, an avowed enemy of all organized religion. He considered all self-proclaimed prophets to be charlatans, and this is very much the theme of the play. This greatly offended Napoleon. He told Goethe, quote, "That is not a good work. Voltaire has represented the man who changed the history of the world as a scoundrel worthy of the gallows," end quote. They then moved on to discuss Goethe's own work. The great writer would later recall, quote, "Napoleon then brought the conversation to The Sorrows of Young Werther, which he must have studied in detail. After several perfectly appropriate observations, he mentioned a specific part and said to me, 'Why did you do that? It is not natural.' And he spoke at length on this, and with perfect accuracy. I listened with a calm face, and I replied, with a smile of satisfaction, that I didn't know whether anyone had ever made the same criticism, but that I found it perfectly justified, and I agreed that one could find fault with the passage's lack of authenticity. But, I added, a poet can perhaps be excused for taking refuge in an artifice which is hard to spot when he wants to produce certain effects that could not be created simply and naturally. The emperor seemed to agree with me. He returned to drama and made some very sensible remarks, as a man who had observed the tragic stage with a great deal of attention, like a criminal judge, and who felt very deeply how far the French theater had strayed from nature and truth. He went on to talk about fatalistic plays, of which he disapproved. They belonged to the Dark Ages. Why today do they keep giving us destiny? He said. Destiny is politics. I must also note that in the whole of our conversation, I had admired the variety of his affirmative replies and gestures, because he was rarely immobile when he listened. Sometimes he made a meditative gesture with his head and said, "Yes," or "That's right." Or, if he had stated some idea, he would most often add, "And what would Monsieur Goethe think of that?" End quote. Napoleon then asked Goethe some personal questions, mostly about his family. Then his aides began bringing business to his attention, and the conversation was over. You might think this great, celebrated genius would have been a bit offended by Napoleon's frank criticisms of his work, but Goethe took it in stride. He had been impressed by Bonaparte before their meeting, and left with an even higher opinion. It seems he was flattered that a great man like Napoleon had read his work closely enough to be able to offer such thoughtful criticisms. Napoleon must have been impressed as well, because shortly after this meeting, Goethe was awarded the Medal of the Legion of Honor, somewhat rare for a non-Frenchman. The great writer was deeply moved by this gesture and wore the medal for the rest of his life. Even years after Waterloo, when Napoleon's empire was long gone and public opinion in Germany had very much turned against Bonaparte, Goethe would continue proudly wearing that medal, a token of esteem from a man his countrymen saw as their greatest enemy. In his old age, Goethe said of the emperor, quote, "Napoleon was the man, always enlightened, always clear and decided, and endowed with sufficient energy to carry into effect whatever he considered advantageous and necessary. His life was the stride of the demigod, from battle to battle and from victory to victory." It might well be said of him that he was found in a state of continual enlightenment. On this account, his destiny was more brilliant than any the world had seen before him, or perhaps will ever see after him. End quote. Perhaps Goethe would have come away with a different impression if he could see how Talleyrand and Alexander were carrying on behind Napoleon's back. The Russian emperor remained immovable. Napoleon flattered, begged, and raged. He offered diplomatic and even territorial concessions. He gave Alexander a new horse. None of it seemed to make an impression. Of course, it was easy to ignore Napoleon's bluster when you had one of his top advisors informing you that it was, in fact, nothing but bluster. Late in the Congress, Napoleon and Talleyrand were conferring privately. The emperor was even more intense than usual. Clearly, he had something big on his mind. Talleyrand would later recall their conversation, quote, "His agitation was remarkable. He asked me questions without waiting for the answer. He was trying to tell me something. He said what he didn't mean. At last he got out the great word, divorce." End quote. We'll discuss this in more detail in a future episode, but for now, suffice it to say that by mid-1808, Napoleon was resolved to divorce Josephine, his great love. He wanted to remarry immediately, a political marriage, fitting of a great monarch. Specifically, he wanted to marry one of Emperor Alexander's young sisters, thus binding France and Russia even closer together. The fact that he brought this up now, while he was in the middle of negotiating with Alexander, makes me wonder if he could sense that Alexander was drifting away from him. That if he hoped to keep Russia as an ally in the long term, he needed to do something drastic to shore up the relationship. Talleyrand informed Alexander of this conversation almost immediately. Alexander wrote to his mother and told her to find suitable fiancés for his sisters immediately. By the time Napoleon got around to asking, both women would be safely engaged to steady men from well-established aristocratic families. As the Congress drew to a close, Napoleon kept up the pressure on Alexander. The Russians would have to give him something. After all, the two countries were still allies, even if it hadn't really seemed that way for the past few weeks. In the end, Alexander did throw France a few bones, but nothing approaching what Napoleon had been hoping for. On October 12, 1808, the two sides agreed to the Convention of Erfurt. Only one of its 14 clauses mentioned Austria at all. The relevant part of that clause reads, quote, "In case Austria should engage in war against France, the Emperor of Russia agrees to declare himself against Austria and to make common cause with France." End quote. Napoleon had gone to Erfurt hoping to secure a firm commitment from Alexander. That language is anything but firm. There is no mention of declarations of war, or deployments of soldiers, or timetables, or anything tangible. Practically speaking, Alexander hadn't committed to anything at all. Napoleon was so disappointed with the agreement that he never actually got around to ratifying it. He would have been even more disappointed if he knew that Alexander had already provided secret assurances to the Austrians, telling them he had no intention of joining any future war between the French Empire and the Habsburg realms. It's impossible to know for certain how much damage Talleyrand's betrayal had done to Napoleon's cause. Perhaps Alexander would have refused anyway, and could have resisted the pressure without any help. Personally, I doubt he could have succeeded so completely without Talleyrand. The wily diplomat did not come away from Erfurt empty-handed. In exchange for his services, Alexander promised a marriage between an eminent Russian noblewoman and Talleyrand's nephew and sole heir. In his memoirs, Talleyrand closes his discussion of the Congress this way, quote, "It was the last service I was able to render Europe as long as Napoleon continued to reign. And this service, in my opinion, I was also rendering to himself personally." End quote. That's a very interesting sentence. Talleyrand seems to have believed, or at least claims to have believed, that in betraying Napoleon, he was actually doing him a favor. Talleyrand wanted to use Alexander to create a guardrail to keep Napoleon from careening off a cliff and direct him back to the righteous path. If Bonaparte had taken this disappointment at the Congress to heart and accepted certain limitations on his power, both he and France would have been better off. At least, so the argument goes. On the other hand, maybe this is just the type of self-flattering, self-justifying story that intelligent but unprincipled people like Talleyrand tell themselves when they decide the smart move is to do something immoral. Those words were all written after the fact. Perhaps the most obvious explanation is the correct one. The past few months had shown Talleyrand that, as strong as he may have looked, Napoleon would not be able to bring the war to a successful conclusion. Better to get on the winning side while the getting was good. Over the course of this show, we've seen a lot of people try to stop Napoleon. None of them have had much success. Now he would have to contend with a new kind of enemy, someone very close to him, someone who had helped engineer his rise to power. Someone he had relied upon for advice for almost his entire political career, and who still publicly claimed to be on his side. Napoleon's enemies suddenly had a very powerful ally right at the heart of the French government. Bonaparte's foreign policy vision depended on maintaining the alliance with Russia. After Erfurt, that alliance seemed far less secure than it had a year earlier. He hoped a strategic marriage would solve that problem, but as you've heard, that door was already closing. Almost overnight, the future of Napoleon's new order seemed very uncertain. Bonaparte had failed to secure a strong guarantee from the Russians to get his free hand to go to Spain, but France had been dishonored at Bailen, and he could not let that go unanswered. Free hand or not, Napoleon ordered most of the Grande Armée west from its bases in Germany. The Emperor was going to Spain, with the greatest army in the world at his back. Next episode, we'll get caught up on the military situation in Iberia, and see Napoleon himself finally cross the Pyrenees. Before we go, I want to give a quick personal message to two of my oldest and dearest friends. Ben and Anna, congratulations on your new baby. I'm so excited for you, and I know you're going to be great parents. And I hope you still have time to listen to this show as new parents, and are actually hearing this message. Anyway, until next time, thanks for listening.